So hello everyone, I'm sharing for Lisa, who is the fighting of YouTube today. And
recording in progress.
We have our own faculty, Asmina Avenitaki, who all of you probably already know, Asmina. Mina graduated from Stanford University in 2008 and moved 50 miles across the bay to become a postdoc at Berkeley before moving back to Stanford as a postdoc in 2011. During that period, I was a student, and she gave me some of the first lessons on how to be a good researcher and a very critical thinker. Mina left Stanford and joined PI as a faculty in 2014. And she has since won the New Horizon Prize in 2017, and now is the Aristophanes Chair of AI.
Oh, yeah, great.
So Aristophanes was the first person to present a heliocentric model of our solar system, 2,000 years before Copernicus. So probably Copernicus is the person that most of us remembers. Like Aristophanes, Mina has made important theoretical contributions to various topics, including C3 experts, black holes, super radiance, and split supersymmetry. Quite opposite to Aristophanes, who, as far as I understand, did not attempt to even verify his theory. Mina designed many experiments to look for things that she cared about, and the most important one so far is probably around. Today we'll be hearing about a new experiment based on the effect she discovered with her collaborators, the piezo axionic effect, to look for QCD axion mathematics.
Yeah, thank you so much, Junwoo. I'm very flattered that you made the parallelism with Aristarchos, but I mean, it's a bit much. but thank you though, thank you. Anyway, it's a pleasure to see people in a talk. So as Junwoo said, I will talk to you about a work that I have been doing the past a couple of years, and is still ongoing, with my student, Amalia Madden, and my longtime collaborator, Ken Van Tilburg, who is now faculty at NYU and CCA. So the effect is called, we call this the piezo-axionic effect. And the basic idea behind it is illustrated here. So you take piezoelectric material, piezoelectric crystals, I will tell you what those are, where the spins of the nuclei in these materials are polarized. So if you have an axion dark matter background, what will happen in this background is this material will start oscillating at a frequency set by the dark matter. So this is a preview, and I'm pretty sure there are several things here that are not, you guys are not familiar with. So feel free, by the way, during the talk to interrupt me with questions. I much prefer that than wait until the end, so that I know if you guys are also following. So there are two ingredients in this talk. One is dark matter. First of all, we know dark matter is there. We've seen it through gravitational observations. It's one of the most unquestionable evidence that we have for beyond the standard model physics. There is this component that behaves like matter in the universe. That's five times as much as the ordinary matter component, and it doesn't interact much with light. Now, if you ask, so this is just from gravity. Now, if you go to ask a particle physicist, which a lot of what we do is come up with models of dark matter, you will get, what is your favorite dark matter model? You probably get as many answers as there are particle physicists. If you try to quantify, to put all of those models in perspective, you will find that our ideas of what dark matter can be populate roughly 80 orders of magnitude in energy scale. So when you make dark matter extremely light, and when I say light, I mean billions, something like 20 orders of magnitude lighter than a proton. You will find that the de Broglie wavelength in dark matter becomes, if it's an elementary particle, becomes so large that it doesn't fit inside galaxies anymore. So we cannot explain the structure that we see. Now, as you start making dark matter heavier and heavier, you cross the Planck scale, so then the dark matter can no longer be an elementary particle. And then you start talking about things like matchers or primordial black holes. And then you hit an observational wall at around a fraction of a solar mass, let's call it. And this happens where, because then dark matter will be too granular to explain the structure that we see. Okay? So we've managed over the years to populate that huge energy scale with models quite successfully. I bet there are tons of articles written on this. Now, the next question, though, you should ask your particle physicist friend is, how is your dark matter produced, your favorite dark matter model produced? Does it have a consistent cosmology? And then you will find that most dark matter models actually fail this very basic criterion. This is so an affirmative answer to this question, a very good production mechanism, a very nice cosmological history, is what makes things like weakly interactive massive particles, or so-called WIMPs, extremely popular for the past several decades. And there is tons of experiments, for example, in Snow Lab here in Canada, that people have built to look for them. And very much so. So in this talk, I will describe another large class of such dark matter candidates, which are bosonic in nature. And in particular, I'll be talking about something called axions. And I will tell you about their properties and actually how they come about. Now, the other part of my talk talks about an effect that we observe have known for a while, which is called piezoelectricity. And this happens when you take, in some material, if you take a crystal and you apply a pressure on it, so you strain the crystal, you find that voltage, charge, develops on the crystal. Okay? And the combination of these two is what gives rise to the piezoaxionic effect. So piezoelectricity has a very interesting history. The name comes from Greek, piezo, to squeeze, and electricity, electrismos. You already know what that is. It was discovered in the 1800s by the Curie brothers, Jacques and Pierre Curie, Pierre pre-Marie. And what they discovered is material like quartz, Tourmaline, they discovered exactly this, that if you apply strain on them and you change their size, charge develops on their surface. What they didn't, there is also the other guy that came in play, was very important for the development of piezoelectricity, was Lippmann. And he was a mathematician, and he actually predicted the inverse piezoelectric effect. So if you apply voltage in this material, their size will change. You may know, of course, that Pierre got the Nobel Prize for radioactivity. Lippmann also got the Nobel Prize, but not for the piezoelectric effect. He got it because he invented a way to make color photographs in 1908. So actually, formally, no Nobel Prize has been given for this effect, which is in fact quite ubiquitous. Now, the reason this effect arises is because materials, the crystal, because of a fundamental property of the crystal structure of this material, which is a breaking of mirror symmetry. So, and this is what is shown in these pictures here. So here you see quartz. Quartz is formally silicon oxide. Is made up of essentially helixes of tetrahedra formed from a silicon atom in the center and oxygen in the edges of the pyramid. They form a helix, can be left-handed or right-handed, this helix. Turns out in nature, 99% of quartz is right-handed. And if you project it, the unit lattice into one of the symmetry planes, you see that you can represent it from like a hexagon. You see here that this hexagon, if you do a reflection around the center of this hexagon, you see that it breaks mirror symmetry. Now, this is very important because when you change the size of the unit lattice in this way, stretch it, you see that you develop charge across the side. You turn this unit lattice into a dipole. And this is the essence of the piezoelectric effect. As I mentioned before, no Nobel Prize has been given for the piezoelectric effect. But over the past 100 plus years since its discovery, we know it. We know the properties of the material very well. We can classify their crystal structure. And they have several applications. In fact, cell phones have a piezoelectric effect, has a piezoelectric crystal in them. Pacemakers keep people alive, so piezoelectrics keep people alive. And microphones, or even crazier ideas like energy recovering shoes, are based on piezoelectrics. So the key point of this is that the material I will be talking about today, it has some exotic properties, but there is nothing that we don't fundamentally understand about them. And they've been applied to technology for quite some time. As I said, one of the fundamental things about these piezoelectric crystals is that they break parity or mirror symmetry. And I will discuss a bit about it and talk about it, start from the microscopic world and continue to the macroscopic world. Then I will connect this property to axions and axion dark matter. Finally, I will put these things together and explain to you how in fact, this piezoaxionic effect arises. So parity violation is not, is not a fundamental symmetry of nature. Okay? This is a summary of all the particles of what we call the standard model now R. You see here the quarks, the leptons, the force carriers, and the Higgs boson. The parity is very important for gauge symmetries in the standard model, whose force carriers are the photon for electromagnetism, the gluon for the strong interaction that keeps nuclei together, and the W and Z boson, who are responsible for radioactivity. And turns out that we've discovered that it's the W and Z boson that violate parity. Their weak interactions violate parity. And because, as the name suggests, it's weak, it took a while to establish that. And that happened in the 50s. So C. N. Young and T. D. Lee suggested that weak interactions, radioactive processes, violate parity. And they approached Madame Wu at the University of Columbia to conduct an experiment. The experiment was the following. They took a nuclei of cobalt-60. They aligned them. The nucleus of cobalt-60 has angular momentum. They aligned them in a strong magnetic field. And they observed that during the radioactive decay of the cobalt to nickel, there was an asymmetry in the emission of the electrons. If you look at angle theta, the emission at 180 minus theta, in 180 degrees minus theta, was not the same. So this is what Madame Wu discovered. And she was the cause of them getting the Nobel Prize, even though she didn't get the Nobel Prize, as you may know. And of course, even back then, to their credit, they both advocated for her to get the Nobel Prize to no avail. And it's a huge scandal. Nevertheless, the fact remains that she made the amazing discovery that parity is not a fundamental symmetry of nature. Now, this is something that we don't think much about. The reason is that parity is broken every day. Like a table breaks parity, a chair breaks parity. We break parity, okay? But in fundamental interactions, exactly because the weak interactions are so weak, the effects of parity violations are small. First of all, one very important takeaway from this is that because I'm talking about the standard model and fundamental interactions, what this parity violation, the weak interactions implies is that, or is based on, is that elementary particles have parity, have mirror symmetry. They have intrinsic symmetries that are very important for their properties. And this is something that you need to keep in mind for the rest of the talk. Now, as I said, the force that's responsible for the radioactivity is very small. So the question is, why is it that everyday life breaks parity so much, given that electromagnetism or the strong force do not break parity at all? There is something called, this is a small parenthesis, there is something called that you, now that for the students now you may have done the standard model, something called spontaneous symmetry breaking. For example, and we see it all the time, in a crystal, translational invariance is broken. This is translational invariance is a symmetry of our fundamental theories that ensures that momentum is preserved in fundamental interactions. In a crystal, this is broken. But we're not worried because this is spontaneous breaking. It, at low energies, I can have a symmetry broken, but at high energies, the symmetry is still there. Similarly, you can have spontaneous breaking of mirror symmetry of parity at low energies. Now, the question is, naively, you would say, I break the mirror symmetry, then I should have one mirror image, same amount as the other mirror image, 50-50 in nature. Turns out that's not the case. For example, in quartz, 99%, as I said, is the right-handed version of quartz. They believe it has to do something with interactions of the environment. But this continues to be, for example, the DNA helix as a single, most of the time, one orientation. And this is something that they don't understand fundamentally. It looks like fundamentally interactions with our environment appear to be important, but in what way, it's not clear. Anyway, this is just fun fact. Now let's go to axions. I talk to you about how axions come into parity violation and what happens when they are dark matter. And in order to understand that, we need to talk about something that axions are invariably connected with, the fundamental electric dipole moments. So electric dipole moments for an elementary particle violate both parity symmetry as well as another symmetry, time reversal, basically taking t to minus t. And you can see it here. So let's say this is a neutron, and it has a spin, magnetic moment. Now the electric dipole moment, if it has a fundamental electric dipole moment, we expect it to be parallel to the magnetic moment. If I take r to minus r to a parity transformation, you will see that the electric dipole moment flips sign and the magnetic moment has remained the same. So this means that my system is not invariant under parity. Now, if I take t to minus t, the magnetic moment is a pseudo-vector, so it flips sign, and the electric dipole moment remains the same. So again, for an electric dipole moment, fundamental electric dipole moment violates both parity and time reversal symmetries. In the standard model, none of these two symmetries, especially parity, and I haven't said, nor time reversal, are fundamental. So if this were the neutron, we actually expect that it should have a fundamental electric dipole moment. And and we haven't measured it. So in the standard model Lagrangian, the electric dipole moment of the neutron will arise from a term like this that mixes the electric field of the strong interactions with the magnetic field of the strong interactions, and its effects are parameterized by this parameter theta. So you would expect that the electric dipole moment of the neutron that characterizes the charge asymmetry would be of order of the charge, the fundamental unit of charge, E times the femtometer, the size of the neutron, times this parameter theta. Turns out, though, that we were expecting this to be order one, but we only managed to constrain it to be smaller than 1 part in 10 to the 10. And this is what is known as the strong CP problem of the standard model. This has been a problem for quite some time, and this is where the axiom comes in. The axiom was proposed as a solution to this fundamental problem of our theory. So they said, okay, let's say this theta angle is a fundamental field, dynamical field, the axiom, and it's cosmological. One can see once you do that, its cosmological evolution naturally relaxes the value of theta close to zero. At the same time, this axion, because it couples to the strong interactions, gets its mass from non-perturbative effects. And its properties are uniquely characterized by what is known as the axion decay constant, which, if close to the gut scale, this axion would have a mass of about 10 to the minus 10 eV, which is, 20 orders of magnitude lighter than the proton. So, or it would have a de Broglie wavelength of about Compton wavelength, of about 3 kilometers. So we're talking about particles that are much, much lighter than anything that we have measured in the standard model. As I said, this is an excellent dark matter candidate. And this is a summary of its parameter space. It doesn't include everything. It's very crude. So its parameter space is uniquely, as I said, uniquely characterized by the axion decay constant, which corresponds to a specific mass. So axion decay constants below 10 to the 9 GeV are essentially excluded by astrophysical observations, stellar cooling, supernova bounds, and so forth. Above the Planck scale, there is some theoretical bias of why you don't want to go there. The electromagnetic cavity searches that I will talk about briefly operate at masses of around 10 to the minus 5 eV, which corresponds to centimeter size in Compton wavelength. And the piezoaxionic effect seems somewhere in between. As I said, because the axion is associated with electric dipole moment, it inherits its transformation property. So the electric dipole moment is a parity odd and time reversal odd quantity. So this means that the axion as a particle will have the same exact transformation properties under these fundamental symmetries. And if the axion is the dark matter, it will create a background that automatically violates these symmetries. Okay. Now, I would like to take the QCD axion is not the only type of axion that can exhibit these properties. Axions are particles that arise in even larger extensions of the standard model, like string theory. String theory, generic versions of string theory, have three fundamental ingredients. They need extra spatial dimensions to make the theory mathematically consistent. You have particles that live in these extra dimensions. And you also have a topology. Basically, these extra dimensions you need to compactify to give rise to our four-dimensional world. And you can compactify them in many different ways. You can compactify them on a sphere. You can compactify them on a torus. And in fact, the way these can be compactified is only limited by the by our imagination. Now, turns out that if you combine these three ingredients, the extra dimensions that are compactified and the particles that live in these extra dimensions, you will see that these particles in these extra dimensions will manifest themselves in four dimensions like ultralight particles that have properties similar to that of the axion. Okay? And there is perhaps a simple analogy to understand this, which is the Aharonov-Bohm effect. Now, in the Aharonov-Bohm effect, you have a solenoid, and you have a current running around the solenoid. That happens, there is a magnetic field inside. If I take an electron and take it on a closed loop around the solenoid in a region where the magnetic field is zero, so there is no force on the electron, there is still a physical phase shift on the electron's wave function as proportion to the electric charge times the magnetic flux that threads the solenoid. Now, so there is a physical effect without a force. In this case, this happens because the electromagnetic field formally creates a non-trivial gauge field configuration around the solenoid that you can that you cannot gauge away everywhere at once. Okay. So now let's turn this by 90 degrees. Now, so even though there is no force, so there is no energy stored outside the solenoid, it still took us some energy to create the configuration because there is energy stored in the core of the solenoid. Okay? Now let's imagine, let's go back to string theory for a second, and let's imagine the same setup is embedded in these extra dimensions. But now because I have the handle from non-trivial geometry, I am allowed to remove the core of the solenoid without getting rid of the non-trivial gauge field configuration. So I'm left with something that can have a physical effect while carrying no energy. So this is what happens in the extra dimensions. In the four dimensions, this appears like a new particle, which has similar properties of that of the axion. So axions have been looked for in many ways. They can mediate new forces. As I said, they're extremely constrained by astrophysics, some parts of its parameter space. And they are excellent dark matter candidates. So this is what I will talk about now. So what happens if axions are dark matter? What they do, in fact, is they change the way we think about dark matter. Usually, when you think about dark matter particles, elementary particles in the galaxy, you think about point particles zooming around, just like, and this is a very traditional picture that we see in weakly interactive massive particles. Now we know that this is not the case. We know that in reality we should think about dark matter as wave packets whose size is set by the de Broglie wavelength of the dark matter. Now, when dark matter is heavy, these wave packets are quite distinct, and either we talk about them as individual particles or wave packets, it doesn't matter. In fact, it's more convenient to talk about individual particles. But as dark matter becomes lighter and lighter, eventually the wave packets start overlapping. For fermions, this cannot happen because of Pauli's exclusion principle. So, in fact, there is a cosmological constraint on a fermion dark matter mass that's about 70 eV, coming just from Pauli's exclusion principle. For bosons, there is no such constraint because bosons can have large occupation numbers. So now if the density, then when the density of bosons becomes very large, it becomes more convenient, instead of talking about individual particles, to talk about dark matter waves, where there is a potential energy set by the mass of the particle, and the dark matter oscillates with the frequency of the mass. Now, for the galaxy, for our galaxy, and around the region of the Earth, this transition of convenience happens when the dark matter mass, when basically the density becomes larger than the de Broglie volume, 1 over the de Broglie volume the dark matter occupies. And this happens when the dark matter is roughly 1 eV in mass in our galaxy. So then, instead of talking about particles, we talk about a wave whose amplitude is set by the square root of the dark matter density, and it's inversely proportional to the mass. And the frequency of oscillation is set by the total energy of the dark matter, which is just the mass. And because dark matter in the galaxy is non-relativistic, and it's virialized, this wave is not strict, very monochromatic. It has a little energy frequency spread of about 10 to the minus 6 of the nominal frequency. The way this dark matter came about is something that is known as the misalignment mechanism. So this wavy dark matter, if you look at the cosmological equation evolution, you will see that it looks very similar to that of a harmonic oscillator. So the mass here plays the role of the resonant frequency of the oscillator. The Hubble term is the frequency term of the oscillator. So in the early universe, Hubble is very large. So the harmonic oscillator is in the overdamped regime. It means that it's just basically frozen. It's like moving through very thick honey. And there is no reason a priori to believe that this harmonic oscillator sits at the origin of this potential. We know, for example, that inflation, quantum fluctuations during inflation, will kick this field around. As the universe cools, this harmonic oscillator transitions from the overdamped to the underdamped regime. And what you see then, when that transition happens, you see that the energy density stored in that oscillator scales like ordinary cold dark matter. This is what is known as the misalignment mechanism for dark matter production. It's a non-thermal production mechanism. And in many ways, it's a nightmare scenario because so far I haven't told you how dark matter coupled to us. So in principle, you could have a pure gravitational coupling of dark matter. And then good luck trying to find it in the lab. Even in that case, there are ways to look for it, but this is not the subject of the talk. Now, today, the amplitude of the oscillation has damped down quite a bit. And for the QCD axion that I talked about earlier, this amplitude is 1 part in 10 to the 18. So we're talking about tiny, tiny fluctuations for the amplitude of these waves. Now, as I said, you could be in a nightmare scenario, and this tiny oscillation does not couple to anything. Luckily for us, in models like axions, there are concrete ways that they couple to us, and you can build experiments to look for these particles in a laboratory setting. The first experiment to successfully do so is the ADMX experiment, which is currently running at the University of Washington in Seattle. In those experiments, they look for the axion coupling to photons. And the way they look for it is they take a region where they apply a strong magnetic field. And under the influence of that strong magnetic field, an axion can convert it to photons because of the presence of this coupling. In order to enhance the rate of conversion, they built a resonant experiment where this B field is applied inside a cavity whose size matches the Compton wavelength of the axion. So you resonantly convert axions to photons of exactly the same frequency. Now going back to the properties of, go ahead.
Why did they use magnetic field instead of electric?
Good, so that's an excellent question. The reason is that I love natural units wherever h bar is CR1. In those units, you can compare the energy density that we can create in a lab from a magnetic field and an E field. E fields, electric fields, require charge separation. And the moment you start separating charges by large distances, you get basically breakdown of the electric field. You start pulling out electrons from the wall. So things want to neutralize. Magnetic fields we can create because we can move positive charges or negative charges relative to one another, like you do in a wire. In a wire is electrically neutral, but you still generate a B field because there's electrons moving. So because it's just easier. An E field will also convert, will do the same job. It's just that in terms of energy density, which is what you want. So the conversion rate is proportional to the amplitude of the B field squared. So it becomes much easier, but that's an excellent question. Nayesh, you have a question?
Yeah. So, I mean, the coupling you had before was for a strong, the FF dual you had for a strong interaction, but now you had with the electromagnetic one.
Yeah, that's the same.
Yeah, but so.
Yeah.
Why do they have the same Fs, basically? So, because there are different interactions.
Sorry, I don't understand your question.
This F is electromagnetic, right?
No, this is not electromagnetic. This alpha is the fine structure constant here. This is the axion decay constant. Oh, yeah, sorry. The question is, actually, I don't understand the question. Sorry. Nayesh, you have to tell me again.
So the motivation for axion was the FF dual term for the...
That was for the strong inter. So the question. So you're asking where does this decay constant come from? Okay, great. So the question is where does this decay constant come from, in particular for the QCD axion? So it is a question about the UV completion of the theory. So the way this formally arises is because the axion is charged under an anomalous symmetry, the Petrie-Quist symmetry. So these terms quantify how much this anomaly is. Now, it's so there is always some irreducible coupling of the axion. So in the UV, if you, depending on the charges, you expect a similar size up to this coefficient that depends on the gauge coupling strength. You expect a similar size in the coupling between FF dual and GG dual. But in reality, it is indeed model dependent. And it can be smaller than the naive expectation. You cannot make it absolutely zero because you will get a mixing of the axion with the pion. So you will have some effects from non-perturbative QCD effects. So it can be smaller. But exactly. So in fact, the experiment I'm going to be talking about will be looking for the model independent coupling. So you identify actually, so there is a range for the QCD action that this value can occupy. So I've been very, very, but this is an excellent point. Yes?
Okay, let me re-ask the question.
Okay, good.
Does the QCD axion, it couples to gluons?
Yeah.
Does that say that it couples also to photons?
Yes, up to some level, if you don't want to tune, yes. But it doesn't have to be this effective FA. This coupling will be up to a factor of 100 or so smaller compared to QCD when you take that minimal coupling. So the phi will be larger, so the coupling is smaller. Does that make sense? So the question was about whether coupling to QCD imply a minimal coupling, and the answer is yes. Good, great. So now, I told you about the symmetry properties of the axion. Let's look at this conversion of axions to photons under this lens of symmetry properties. So, as I said before, the axion dark matter produces a time-dependent oscillating parity and time reversal symmetry background. So the reason that you need the B field when you convert it to photons, and here you see it, if you want to convert a photon, will have an E field component, which is P odd and T even. So if you want to preserve P odd, a time reversal invariance, you need to apply something T odd, which is the B field. So that's why the B field is a very important component of these experiments. Okay, you couldn't do this search without a B field. Now, similarly here, the thing that I will be talking about, the piezoaxionic effect, takes advantage of this P odd and T odd properties of the axion to produce something that's P even and T even. Okay? which is, and that happens because the role of the B field in the cavity searches, here it's played by the fundamental piezoelectric crystal in combination with nuclear spins. The piezoelectric crystal itself breaks parity, when you convert it, when the axion dark matter results into stress, which is P even, you make sure parity is preserved. And if you have aligned nuclear spins that violate T-breaking, combined with the T-breaking properties of the axion field, they can be converted to a T even stress. Okay? And as we discussed earlier, this experiment looks for the model-independent coupling of the QCD axion, the coupling, the one that's responsible for solving the strong CP problem in the standard model. So this is a rough, again, sketch of our experimental setup. You take a strong B field to align the nuclear spins. You have the P-odd piezoelectric crystal. And then if there is an axion background that couples to the nuclei, it will produce a strain. So now we will estimate how much that strain is. So any more questions so far? Yes?
Sorry, can you explain once again how the action feels like a physical stress on the piezoelectric?
This is what I will explain to you just now. I will, okay. So this is like a summary of what I'm about to do. So this is, so I will take you through the steps because actually it's a very long story. took us quite some time to figure that part out. So anyway, let's go back to something you've seen before. Let's go back to quartz again. And now let's talk about the fundamental equations, the constitutive equations that describe the motion of the properties of this crystal. So if you have a strain, if you change the size of a crystal, it produces a stress, okay? Or if you have a displacement field on a crystal, it produces an electric field. And this happens for every crystal, for any material. This is just this epsilon here is just the dielectric constant, and this is what you know as Young modulus, right? You stretch a crystal, there is a restoring force. Now, what makes piezoelectric special is that you add these two terms in blue. So a displacement field, some electric dipole moment inside the crystal, can produce a force on the crystal, a stress. And vice versa, a strain, a change in the size of the crystal, can produce an electric field. And this E quantity here is this is what is known as the piezoelectric tensor. These two terms in these equations are only present for piezoelectric material, okay? Now, because of the symmetries of the problem, we expect the axion to enter the following way. It will introduce two new tensors that are compatible with the symmetries of the problem. So theta here is the axion field, P is the polarization of the nuclear spins, and C and zeta are two new tensors that will produce and then will go and will compute in the next few slides. C is what we call the piezoaxionic tensor. This is responsible, so this is the tensor that is responsible for coupling the axion field directly to stress and strain. And there is another tensor, what we call the electroaxionic tensor, which basically couples the axion field to electric field. This one I'm not going to talk about a lot, but it's still there. And in fact, you probably won't see it right away, but the point is that this is true for every material that has aligned nuclear spins. So one of the properties of the axion, as I said, it's related to electric dipole moments. So if you have an axion background, it will create an oscillating electric dipole moment for nuclei. So if I take the electric dipole moments and I align them, if you remember from Jackson, you probably done this type of problem, you will see that aligned electric dipoles produce a macroscopic electric field. And this is true independently of for any type of material, crystal, amorphous crystal, gas, anything. So this tensor zeta is not special to piezoelectrics. This piezoaxianic tensor, though, is the one that breaks parity, and it's special to piezoelectrics. And we go to the question. Sorry, going too fast. Now the question you asked is, how do we go? Now I've told you that axion couples to gluons. So how do we go from the gluons to the nucleus? How do we go from the gluons to the atoms? How do we go from the atoms to the crystal to see, to calculate a macroscopic property? So let's start, first of all, from the nucleus inside the atom. And this is very important. So for an atom, so if you have an electric dipole moment either of the electron or the nucleus in an atom, you would expect that naively, the first P and T violating moment you will see, the first P and T violating moment you will see is again an electric dipole moment that is of the same size as either the nuclear electric dipole moment or the electric dipole moment of the electron. Turns out that this is not the case. This is something that Schiff proved in the 50s, and he showed that if you have a point-like electric dipole moment for the nucleus or for the electron cloud inside the atom will shift around to cancel the effects of the electric dipole moment, okay? And this is what you see here. This is true in the electrostatic limit, and this was a reason why a lot of, in fact, this is a very important fact for all permanent electric dipole moment searches in a laboratory setting. Now, this Schiff's theorem is violated by finite size effects. You can only cancel the electric field from the electric dipole moment exactly at a point. So if the particle is not a point, you'll have finite size effects. Or if the particle is moving, like the electron is moving around the nucleus, then there's going to be time retardation effects. There's going to be retardation effects, so that will also undo the cancellation. So for nuclei, the most important effects, well, there's both finite velocity effects, but also finite size effects. For the things that we are interested in, the important things are the finite size effects. So instead of an electric dipole moment of an atom, you should be, in fact, checking for the next moment that violates P and T, which is an octuple, okay? An electric quadruple does not violate P and T, and you can do it in a piece of paper. It won't be obvious now. So if you have that, what does that mean? It means that if I have a fundamental electric dipole moment for a nucleon, or the nucleus, the effective atomic dipole moment will be suppressed by the size of the nucleus over the size of the atom squared. And this is a factor of a loss of 10 orders of magnitude. So you naively say, okay, this is a great loss. So how do we recover that? Turns out there are several accidents that happen that go to our favor to recover many of these 10 orders of magnitude suppression. So first of all, let's say, as I said, if you have an axion coupling to GG dual, this will generate a shift moment for the nucleus that is proportional to the axion oscillation amplitude. And it's also proportional to the size of the nucleus squared. So if you have large nuclei, their size grows with the more nucleons they have. So you gain a factor of the atomic number to the 2/3. Now, there are these special classes of nuclei as well that are asymmetric. You probably know them because they're, most of the time they are radioactive. For example, uranium is one. Uranium is a great nucleus for this type of experiment. And what happens in these nuclei, they are not spherically symmetric. So there is a huge charge asymmetry that enhances the shift moment. So you gain a factor of Z, the number of protons you have. For things like the uranium, this is roughly a factor of 100. Great, so we recovered some. Now, let's go to the atom. So this shift moment will interact with the electron cloud with an operator that looks like this, okay? This is the shift moment. It's aligned along the spin of the nucleus. And this grad is applied to a delta function, which is applied on the electron cloud. So this operator here is applied, it cares about the electron wave function. So, and this is in the limit, of course, where the nucleus is essentially a point. Now, in large atoms, this operator cares about the value of the electron wave function close to the nucleus. So the electron sees the full on-screen charge of the nucleus, which is extremely important. So when you do all the math, you find that there's an additional factor of z squared that comes in. Just because of the fact this operator is extremely sensitive to the on-screen charge of the nucleus. So you see here that, in fact, you have recovered most of the 10 orders of magnitude suppression. If you put z and a of order 100, you see that you've gained a lot of ground. Now, we still need to measure this, okay? So if we do the first thing we would imagine is that we do perturbation theory. And we say, okay, so we need to calculate the energy shift of the atom. So we take the wave function of the atom and we apply this operator. Great. The problem is that if you do it for a free atom, this gives you exactly zero, unless you apply an electric field. So this is where the searches for permanent electric dipole moments come in. But in a piezoelectric crystal, the wave function of the atom is in a superposition of opposite parity states because parity is badly broken inside a piezoelectric crystal. So if I do perturbation theory, I see that the expectation value of this energy perturbation of the atom inside the crystal is non-zero. Okay? Small and non-zero, it's proportional, it's this value, it's a tiny value, it's proportional to theta bar, which is the amplitude of the axion field, and it oscillates with the frequency of the axion field. Now we can convert this energy shift into a tensor, okay? And from this energy shift for each of the atoms, we can calculate the shift in the energy density of the crystal, and we can do perturbation theory based on the properties of the symmetries of the crystal, and calculate an effective piezoaxionic tensor whose size should grow like something like the amplitude, the size of the small perturbation, the volume of the unit cell, this xi tilde, and this parameter xi tilde, which parameterizes how strong piezoelectricity is in the crystal, okay? And for most crystals is order one. Turns out, for example, for quartz, there's a small suppression. So this is like a tenth, or maybe a bit smaller. I think it's a tenth. So this is a process. Now we've calculated the size of the effect. So this tells us that the effect is maximized for crystals that have strong piezoelectricity, are dense, basically they have small unit cells, and they have nuclei with large shift moments. So basically large nuclei, okay? So going back to the picture that I've shown before, so if there is axion dark matter, then we know the piezoelectric tensor will cause a change in the size of the crystal that's fractionally of this size, 1 part in 10 to the 26, okay? And before you say anything, yes, this is really small, okay? So the question is how do we go about measuring this tiny effect? And the way we would measure this tiny effect is by actually using techniques that people had already used. So the idea is relatively simple. I will say simple because people have done this before. Not not for the specific material that we need, but for similar, for other types of crystals, piezoelectrics. So you take a B field, you polarize the nuclear spins, and then you take two electrodes, and if there is an axion, and you attach them to the crystal, if there is an axion background, the crystal will start oscillating. If it starts oscillating, changes its size, it will produce a current in the circuit, and then you can pick it up with a squid. Okay? That's the idea. And yes?
What is the B not doing?
This is the B field. You need to polarize the spins. It doesn't have to be on very large all the time, but you need somehow to polarize the nuclear spins. It's not important for the detection, but it's important for preparing the crystal. So the question is, what do you need the B field for? So as I said, this is part of these things people have done before, and they've done it for gravitational wave detection. So people have attached it electrodes onto big aluminum bars and try to measure the tiny tidal force that the gravitational wave imparts as it goes through this bar. If the resonant frequency of the bar matches the frequency of the gravitational wave, you resonantly excite an acoustic mode, and you can measure it. Now, this is the original idea that Weber, the University of Maryland, started doing in the 60s. In fact, there was a bit of controversy because he thought he had discovered gravitational waves of this strain and size. I mean, it was clear it wasn't true. Nevertheless, he started a technique that's now well established, and resonant mass detectors, bars that look for the tidal force from oscillating gravitational waves, can now show strain sensitivity of 1 part in 10 to the 25. If you convert it, this is the Auriga detector that has this type of sensitivity. The Auriga detector is a 2-meter aluminum bar. Now, if you were to convert it in the absolute distance measurement, this is 10 orders of magnitude smaller than the size of a nucleus. So they can detect a change in the size of this bar smaller than 10 orders of magnitude of the size of the nucleus. In absolute length measurement, this is way more sensitive than LIGO is. LIGO gains a lot because you have kilometer-sized arms. The absolute strength, the precision at which you measure the position of the mirror is about 10 to the minus 18 meters. This is about 10 to the minus 20-something meters. Okay? So this is a very well-developed technique. Now, what we need to do is change the materials that we use. And this is the non-trivial part of what we are proposing. Luckily for us, there are several things that work in our favor. There are several. Piezoelectricity is a very common property and very well-studied property for many crystals. Of course, not every crystal will work. You need material, nuclei that have large shift moments, like neptunium, europium, uranium, samarium, neodymium. So there's tons of candidates. Not tons, but several candidates. You also need to have low mechanical losses. You need to build a good resonator. You need to build something with low noise. And you need, of course, something that has large piezoelectric constant. Now, this is a table that Amalia put together. And it shows that you don't have to remember any of this. The key point of this is that, yes, we have candidate materials that we can use for this type of experiment. So, of course, now the elephant in the room, of course, is the following. Tell you, oh, you have a bar. A bar has a set mechanical frequency. It can only resonantly oscillate at one acoustic frequency, like a tuning rod. But we don't know a priori what the axion frequency is, so we need to scan. And the question is, how do we do that? There are several ways one can do that. First of all, each object does not have a single harmonic, has several harmonic modes, so you can observe all of them at once. The other thing you can do is use the piezoelectric properties of this crystal and attach variable inductive elements to the circuit. So by attaching variable inductive elements, you change the resonant electric resonance of the circuit, and that helps scanning around the resonant frequency. So you can go from something that would naively have a very narrow bandwidth to something that has a bandwidth of a few percent. Okay? There are backgrounds, and we can talk about them later. We think that those can be controlled. And I guess we're almost there. So and this is actually, let's call it the money plot. So this is what you see here, is the coupling of the axion to gluons as a function of the axion mass. The green line is the QCD axion. It's a line because there's a prediction for that. And for different parameters, this is, we can do somewhere, we believe we can do somewhere between the yellow here. This should be taken, I can discuss later the details of what to make this plot. Cavity searches are here. Astrophysical searches like black hole superaddians are here. So in many ways, this is complementary to other experiments that are already happening. There are other axion couplings we can be looking for that just break parity and not time reversal symmetry. So a crystal has sensitivity to those as well at the same time. Now, there are several things to do. Most important thing is to identify the optimal material and the optimal setup for this experiment. There are precise calculations that we need to do to calculate with DFT techniques the tensors. And finally, something that we're working on now and we're very excited is you can actually do, well, in fact, this is the inverse period axionic. You can actually, so I told you what axion dark matter effects, axion dark matter can have effects on crystals, but crystals actually can source axions. So you can have the inverse process happen. And by doing that, you can actually mediate new type of forces between matter. So this is something that you can be looking for, and this is something that we are currently working on. So it will mediate so the axions from sourced by ferroelectric material, which is another a subclass of piezoelectrics, will source a monopole dipole force between the ferroelectric material and spins. And this is something that we're working out to figure out how well you can do. And with this, I would like to end. I hope I've given you some idea. I'm not expecting that you would have gotten everything out of this talk. The key point of this is that material with special properties can affect the behavior of dark matter and give rise to unexpected phenomena. So you can give us new tools for look for dark matter or even other particles. So I did this here for the QCD axion, which is a very well-motivated particle. And I described to you this piezoaxionic effect and a possible experimental setup to look for it. Of course, and I would like to leave you with a question. So we did it for the axion, which is a very well-known parity, odd, tiod. Are there any other candidates that exhibit these funny properties in special material? So thank you. Let's wait, just for students. Yeah, no, we don't want. Yeah, because some of them are a bit shy.
Okay, then
the
question for
anyone. Yeah.
I'm also a student in this field. Maybe titanate is a good, it's an example that you also gave.
Yeah.
Now, there is also strontium titanate, which is called a quantum paraelectric. So, it has an additional advantage, there are a lot of local paraelectricity, but they are quantum fluctuating and there is a quantum coherence.
Mm.
So, I'm wondering whether you can make use of.
Yeah.
Quantum, because there are some
Yeah, so the question is good. That's a good question. So The question is whether we can use any sort of quantum coherence for this. It's not clear. We haven't thought about it. In some ways, while the effect is novel, the way we have chosen to detect it is actually very old, true and tried way. So actually one aspect that would be interesting instead of quantum applications that we have not thought about at all. So I didn't go at all into details about how the experiment is run, what are the limitations from the noise. Turns out on resonance, the limitation is thermal noise. So we assume you cool the entire object down to some extremely low ordered millikelvin temperatures, which is very hard. The question is, could you cool down a very specific acoustic mode without cooling out the entire object? So this is where quantum applications can come in. And that we it's not clear, but it's an excellent question. It could be there are applications, but in our mind, we wanted to establish that there is a new effect and have one revolution at a time. So the way we detect it is actually quite conventional in some ways, but it could be possible to use non-trivial quantum techniques to make this effect more easily detectable. Yes?
At the beginning, you mentioned the 99% of course is muon.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's reasonable to view this as a manifestation of parity violation.
Okay. So the question is, if the fact that the quartz helix is 99% right-handed in nature is a manifestation of parity violation from the fundamental interactions you would mean. People have proposed this as an explanation of the parity, the fact that several, or even organic molecules have certain helicities. I think it's highly unlikely, and the reason is decoupling. The energy shift that the weak interactions cause inside an atom is tiny. Every interaction energy that we have is much larger than that. So it's highly unlikely that this parity violation in the fundamental interactions causes the manifest and the huge asymmetry in long scales. So that's why for me it's a huge mystery why, yeah, and it remains a mystery.
And in many other materials, there's no this big imbalance between the two possibilities. So is quartz a unique, kind of a unique material that has this big imbalance?
No, it's not a unique material. That happens all the time. Like, why is our hearts always to the left? I have to check. No,
we are
not parity preserving at all.
We are tiny non-equilibrium, but it's supposed to be close to the equilibrium.
Yeah, it's not. So I don't think. Yeah, it's not clear how that matters. I don't know. There are people I know when I was trying to figure out background material for this talk, I saw there are some experiments that are happening in that regime, but I don't think people have a good understanding of why that happens.
But are there other materials that also have similar properties?
Yeah, tons. I mean, quartz is one, but I mean, piezoelectric, there are 32 known crystal classes. 20 of them have piezoelectric properties, have mirror symmetry breaking. So quartz is just very well known. I'll use this as an example.
I think this is not just a mirror symmetry breaking, right? It's more than that. It's kind of in big imbalance in one direction. There's a.
Oh, you mean the 99%? Oh, yeah, no, there are many other things that do that too, yes. And I don't know, and again, I just don't know, and I don't think anyone really knows why that happened. Yes? Oh, okay. Yeah, but did you have a question? I saw you wanted to raise your hand. Not me. No one. Okay, go ahead.
You mentioned there's some constraint on the coupling strength between axion and strong interaction.
Yeah.
Some minimal, some model dependent coupling. Can you explain it again?
Yeah, so when I go back here, let me exit and see if I can do this. So the question is, to explain a bit more about the model-independent coupling of the axion, and it's right here. So the model-independent coupling of the axion enters in this parameter here. So the point is that if I have a certain decay constant, this is the decay constant that enters this A over F here instead of theta. So then there is an exact prediction. There is a one-to-one relation between the mass and the coupling of the field to gluons, because the coupling of the gluons is the one that's Rossloff, exactly the coupling to the gluons is the one that's responsible to the mass. So in terms of coupling to gluons and QCD, this coupling is what determines most of the, so that's why I'm saying there is, that's why in the plot I had a green line for that. So there's a prediction, yeah.
Constraint is coming from some observable facts instead of coming from some theoretical constraints of anomaly.
So there's no prediction. If you were asking for a prediction of what the value of the decay constant can be, there's no prediction. Yes. Mateusz, I know you, so other people will take. Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you just, I don't really know the orders of magnitude of these things, so it might be completely stupid, but because you're looking for the absolute magnitude of the strain that you can get.
Yeah.
You also get that the strain is going to have this oscillatory pattern with a frequency that...
Yeah, exactly.
So can you use that to, instead of looking for like absolute strains, to look for like highly correlated noise?
No, this is... Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry it wasn't clear, but this is exactly what we're looking for. So the important thing is that, in fact, you have the dark matter, And this part here, I have it. Do you see here? There is time dependence in this strain.
Yes.
So you do look. You're talking. So you don't. We'd never look at the. We don't look for a constant thing. We're looking for the oscillatory thing, which makes the, as you said, it does make the searches much, much easier if you want to look for a pattern instead of something that's constant. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay.
Mateusz?
Yeah, kind of a weird question, but I want to throw the last question that you asked. You know about this much more than any of us. So is there any kind of second leading candidate or target that you really can go after?
I cannot say. That's the problem. I'm not at liberty to say in a public setting. Yes, maybe. So the question was, what other candidates can you have other than the axion? Yeah, there could be other things. But, I mean, think about how many parity odd stuff is there. So, I mean, in principle, you can imagine, let's say something more conventional. We're looking for an oscillatory signal, but can you look for a constant signal? Does it make it constant searches much, much easier? You would think, oh, the constraint on a permanent electric dipole moment is much weaker. So in fact, the signal can be 10 orders of magnitude larger, but the problem is that it's just that the signal is so, it's a constant signal, so it becomes harder to extract, but we haven't thought about it much. Yes, you have a question? Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of the circuit design tools, yeah, the resonant line shift, how big are the magnitudes of the currents or voltages?
Oh God, so we're talking about femtovolt? Or picovolt stuff? Picovolt. We are talking about really small stuff. We're talking about noise level of picovolt per root hertz or something. Really small or smaller. So these are small things. What gives us confidence, as I said, is the fact this technology has been applied by existing experiments to look for gravitational waves. So what scares me personally more is whether or not we'll be able to optimize the material as much as we want. And we need to have a better scanning strategy. That's the other thing that requires a bit more thought, to scan a bit more efficiently than we have. We have some ideas, but I'm not sure if they are optimized.
What you're trying to detect is that the mechanical vibration through the piezoelectric effect is converted to signal,
yes.
That electric signal.
Yes.
So going back to the fundamental interaction that describes axions. So isn't it, I don't know whether it's easier or possible or what, to directly look at
So the point is here secretly. So the question is, yeah. So the question was whether it's easier to look for, why not look for the photon coupling? Is it easier? The answer is for those frequencies that we care about, that this experiment is geared for, the answer is not really. And there are several reasons for that. The main reason is that secretly the signal, so when you go to the frequencies that I was looking at, the wavelength of the axion becomes huge. We're talking about hundreds of meters, kilometers in size. So it turns out that the effect on a experiment like ADMX, the signal goes down by the ratio of the size of the experiment over the size of the axion, at least to one power. That's one thing. The other thing, what this experiment secretly takes advantage of, so the reason that you have very small noise is because you have a lot of mass. So secretly, there is Avogadro's number in there. And this is the other thing that gives you a boost. Now, there is indeed an effect because you break parity, you can look for the photon coupling. We worked out the numbers. We did work out the numbers for the crystals. And for the frequencies that we looked at, it's just the signal is just too small to make it interesting. We have it somewhere in our notes. It's just, unfortunately. Yeah, it's a good thought. I mean, it's not.
Yes, you mentioned that the mass of the axion you can look for set by the size of the experiment, and mm-hmm. you can increase the frequency range by a few percent.
Oh yes.
But then you, I mean, I guess you don't have a good idea exactly what the mass would be even within.
No. Yeah.
Is the idea that you build like several experiments at different sizes?
Good. So Will's question. Yeah, I'm going to repeat your question now because you don't have a mic. So the question is about frequency scanning. So I mentioned quickly that you can scan a few percent around the resonant frequency, but of course you don't know where the axion mass is. You need to scan more than a few percent. There are several ways you can do that. So in fact, in the paper. Let me go here. I'll show something here. Do you see this little like teeth here? This happens because we're actually considering here something that looks like a xylophone. So you build crystals of different size that you observe at once. So this is something that people have thought about on how to expand, again, taken from resonant mass detectors, where people have thought about how to expand the frequency. We, as I said, we haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, how to optimize it, but there is no way, for example, with a single device, you'll be able to scan the entire range. You'll need to be multiple. But there are ways you can do it. So.
But the blue and the red, those are a single device, those are the higher harmonics?
Yeah, they are not the higher harmonics. They are just, this is where we get. So this is like a xylophone setup where you have crystal sizes of 4 to 2 centimeters, where you change the size as you go. Larger sizes correspond to lower frequencies. So this is from 4 to 2 centimeters. So you scan order one in magnitude, and because you have 8 crystals, you had different teeth. And similar here, we have more number of crystals. So one of the problems with going to higher frequencies is because on resonance, you're limited by thermal noise. So your noise goes like inversely, goes like the size to the -3/2 power. So you have something of a smaller size, your noise is worse. So you need to build more and more crystals. And this is why we kind of stop here at around, 100 megahertz or so. But in principle, and I think ultimately, this part needs to be optimized better. Like trying to find also the other thing we could optimize is the mode that we look at. So Amalia, towards the end where we're writing, found a mode that enhances our signal by a factor of 10. We didn't work it out because we thought, okay, that's for something else. Many things have not been optimized because our focus is actually was mostly understanding the effect and showing what needs to be done to get there for the QCD axiom. So there is more work to be done for sure.
Okay, so maybe we should give people like a chance if we have a
question. Yeah.
If not, maybe let's thank me and I again, and then we can continue the discussion.
Thank you, guys.